Dr. William Luther Pierce, 2001, Provocation and Response.
Hello. The situation in Palestine is interesting, both in terms of what is happening over there and in terms of the reflection over here. It's not just the occasional good lick the Palestinians managed to get in against the Jews over there. That's always good to see, of course, but more interesting are the reactions of the media and the government in the United States. For example, the media Jews and their Gentile step and fetch it's here. Time magazine writer Charles Krauthammer is a good example of the former, and columnist George Will is an example of the latter, have been coming out openly in favor of government-sponsored terrorism and assassination, as long as it's Israel doing the sponsoring. And they've been doing that since well before this week's attacks on the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. It is a time-honored Western tradition that the leaders of nations at war treat one another with chivalry. In the past, when leaders actually rode into battle at the head of their men, that meant that it was all right to kill the enemy king or general in a fair fight, but it wasn't all right to send someone sneaking around his castle or his house at night to poison his well or to leap from the bushes and cut his throat. Perhaps it wasn't all chivalry. Perhaps it was in part the understanding that if you engaged in that sort of ungentlemanly behavior, your enemy might retaliate in kind. In any event, assassination of enemy leaders, even in time of war, remained taboo until fairly recently. That is, until Western tradition gave way to Semitic tradition, which is a quite different sort of tradition. That's what happened in the Second World War. After the war, the U.S. government and its allies rounded up the leaders of conquered Germany and, after a farcical show trial, hanged them. It wasn't just the generals who were hanged. It also was Germans whom the Jews hated simply because of things they had said or written. Julius Streicher and Alfred Rosenberg are just two examples of this. Neither man had any leadership role in the war. But before the war, each had made unflattering remarks about the Jews and their activities, and so was hanged for it. Even with their tight grip on the media, the Jews weren't able to keep a few Westerners from expressing their dissatisfaction with this Semitic way of doing things. It did not sit well with many independent-minded Americans that German leaders and writers were hanged, while Soviet and American leaders and writers, who had been far more egregious in their behavior, were held up as heroes. The Jews responded with outrage to any criticism of the travesty of justice they had sponsored at Nuremberg after the war. The Germans had dared to raise their hands or their voices against God's chosen people, and so they had to be punished and Western tradition to the contrary be damned. It's pretty much the same today, with the few Westerners who are bold enough to criticize the Israeli government's policies of torturing Palestinian prisoners or sending disguised death squads into Palestinian territory to assassinate Palestinian leaders in their homes. To the Jews, this behavior is merely self-defense. It's the sort of thing they've always done. The Palestinians are trying to take back the land the Jews stole from them, and the Jews are merely defending themselves. How dare anyone criticize them for that? Charles Krauthammer has a column in the August 27th issue of Time magazine titled, In Defense of Assassination, with the word assassination in quotes, meaning that when Jews do it, it isn't really assassination. He concludes his column with a whining complaint about the Gentile criticism of this Jewish behavior. I quote, "The abuse Israel has suffered for this scrupulous exercise of self-defense in a war it did not start, is yet another example of the outrageous double standard applied to it by a cynical, complicit world. End of quote. Did you get that? A scrupulous exercise of self-defense in a war the Jews didn't start. If not the Jews, then who? And a cynical, complicit world is ganging up on the poor, inoffensive Jews again. Oy vey, wasn't 6 million enough already? The Jews really have a corner on the market in brass. Nearly always, this sort of whining self-righteousness works for the Jews. The bought politicians and the Christian preachers and the George Will types certainly go for it every time. And George Bush isn't about to buck the Jews on anything. He's as obedient a lackey as his predecessor was. But there are signs that, as was the case with the post-war lynchings at Nuremberg, a few Western observers have had about all of this Jewishness they can stomach. And not just Westerners. Watching the bickering at the big United Nations anti-racism conference in Durban, South Africa, has been amusing. The Jews nearly always are able to manipulate such conferences to their advantage by threats and bribery. Threats of U.S. retaliation against anyone who refuses to toe the Jewish party line, and bribes from the U.S. Treasury for those who go along. This time, however, so many delegates at the conference were incensed at the recent Jewish treatment of Palestinians that things didn't go so smoothly for the Jews and their U.S. bully boy. There are even a few signs of unrest among the Jews' frontline troops in the Western media. Do you remember the 12-year-old Palestinian boy, Mohammed al-Durrah, who was shot to death deliberately by Jewish gunmen in Jerusalem nearly a year ago as he huddled against a wall with his father and begged for his life? The Jews pumped 4 rifle bullets into him. They also shot the boy's father, and then they killed a Palestinian ambulance driver who arrived to give aid. It all would have been just a bit of amusing target practice for the Jewish gunman, except that a French cameraman caught it all on film. Before the Jews could squelch it, shocked television viewers around the world had seen it. A British journalist, Sam Kiley, who worked for The Times of London, recently decided to follow up that story. His editors at the newspaper were not enthusiastic about the project, to say the least. In Kiley's own words, "When I pulled off a little scoop by tracking, interviewing, and photographing the unit in the Israeli army which killed Mohammed al-Durrah, the 12-year-old boy whose death was captured on film and became the iconic image of the conflict, I was asked to file the piece, quote, without mentioning the dead kid," unquote. Well, Kiley is a thoroughly wet liberal who normally dotes on Jews and thinks they're just wonderful. But when told that he would have to write his story about the Israeli gunman who murdered the 12-year-old Palestinian boy last September, without mentioning the dead kid, lest it offend the Jews, Kiley resigned from the staff of the Times and began speaking out about the way journalists are constrained to report the news of the conflict in Palestine only in a way that is favorable to the Jews. We shouldn't jump to any conclusions from Kiley's rebellion or the refusal of the delegates at the UN Anti-Racism Conference to knuckle under. But it is something. It is a number of similar happenings recently that has Krauthammer whining in Time magazine that the world is ganging up on the poor Jews again. I wish it were so, but there hardly can be much complicity between the people who take an uncompromising stand against the Jews as Jews, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the miscellaneous anti-racists, such as Kiley and the delegates in Durban, who at the moment are miffed by the Jews' atrocious treatment of the Palestinians. It is the Jews, of course, who have built the anti-racism movement and have pumped all of the Gentile journalistic lackeys who work for them full of anti-racist sentiment. The Jews used this anti-racist sentiment to destroy Rhodesia and white South Africa, just as they're using it to destroy America. And it would be ironic if it is turning even slightly against them now as a consequence of their atrocious behavior in Palestine. I welcome that, but I don't hold out much hope for it in the near future. The Jews' grip on the mass media remains too strong, and it is that grip which controls the behavior of politicians and of governments. Remember, we saw the same sort of disgust with Jewish bloodlust and self-righteousness after the Second World War. But the Jewish media kept it undercover, and it never affected the lemmings or government policies. What's necessary for combating the Jews effectively is a recognition of what they are, not just what they happen to be doing at the moment. It's good when their hypocrisy and their self-righteousness work against them, as when their innate racism shows through their mask of anti-racism and disillusions a few of those whom they have duped. But the Jews' racism is not something we can count on using against them in a decisive way. After all, every healthy individual and every healthy nation is racist. It is in the Jews' nature to deny that fact and to attempt to weaken the racial feelings of others while secretly nurturing their own. That is the way they fight against the non-Jewish world. The motto of Mossad, Israel's principal agency for state-sponsored terror and assassination, is, "By way of deception shalt thou do war." But in fact, that is the principle which governs the relations of Jews as a whole with the non-Jewish world. That is a consequence of what they are. There are times when we too find it expedient to be deceptive. We do whatever we must to survive, but we do not make deception the cornerstone of our existence. And we must never think in terms of alliances with people like Sam Kiley or the delegates at the UN Anti-Racism Conference. Cheer them on whenever they are refusing to take orders from the Jews. Even provide them with ammunition when we can. But never count on them. They are people who, despite their occasional flashes of independence, have been terribly flawed by their acceptance of an ideology manufactured by the Jews to serve Jewish purposes. Among ourselves, at least, we must be honest. We must see things as they really are. We must try to understand the fundamentals and then govern ourselves accordingly. One fundamental is that people do not change their nature any more than the leopard changes his spots. The Jews will not reform themselves. They will not voluntarily stop meddling in the affairs of non-Jews or attempting to use non-Jews for their own purposes. Until they are stopped by a superior opposing force, they will behave as they always have behaved. They always will be hostile to non-Jews, and as long as we permit them, they will attempt to deceive non-Jews, just as the great bulk of our people always will be gullible and will be susceptible to Jewish deception if they are not provided with proper guidance. Another fundamental is that we cannot counter the Jewish deception of the great bulk of our people as long as the Jews retain their control of the mass media of news and entertainment, and we have no equivalent media. At this time, we can only influence the thinking and behavior of the hard-headed, independent-minded minority of our people. But we always must have as our ultimate goal the guidance of all of our people, the shielding of all of our people from deception. A third fundamental is that we must not foolishly imagine that we can achieve some quick and easy victory by building alliances with people whose goals or interests are essentially different from ours. Middle Easterners or other non-whites, for example, or even with people who believe that their goals and interests are different from ours, as is the case with any of our people who still are under the influence of Jewish ideology. Sam Kiley, for example. We must count only on ourselves, on those whose most essential interests are the same as ours and who understand and accept that fact. Our task is difficult, and at this time our progress is slow. But there is progress. The number of people listening to these American Distant Voices broadcasts increases week by week. The number of people who seek out one of our websites on the Internet increases day by day. At natvan.com, they are averaging 19,000 people a day now, which is up 50% from a year ago. Every Saturday, when a new broadcast goes on the net, the number of visitors to natvan.com jumps to nearly 30,000. That's not much compared to the number of viewers on any of the popular Jewish television propaganda programs, a fraction of 1%. We don't have television yet, but we will within the next month. We've just finished making our first music video with a message in both the music and in the images, and you'll be able to see it in a couple of weeks. Look for it at resistance.com. By the end of this year, we'll be producing video documentaries with a message, and some of those will be on cable TV. Of course, we know that we won't have anywhere near as large an audience as Mike Wallace or Oprah, but our viewers will not be the slack-jawed, beer-bellied couch potatoes and multi-culti trendies who make up most of Mike Wallace's and Oprah's audiences. They still can outvote us by a wide margin. But the time is approaching when numbers will not be all that counts, nor will money be the only thing that counts in determining how large an audience one can reach or how much influence one can have on the people one reaches. The whole world is entering a new era now where all their money and the hundreds of millions of mindless lemmings in their television audiences, and being able to manipulate the political system and the government of what is still the world's most powerful country, at least in a material sense, no longer are enough to guarantee the Jews' continued hegemony. What happened in New York and in Washington this week is just one small manifestation of this new era. George Bush and the other politicians under the Jews' control can order the bombing of every pharmaceutical factory in the Middle East in response to recent events here, but that will only take us further into this new era. I've said this before, but I'll say it again now. Not everyone in the world is willing to be dominated by the Jews. What happened this week is a direct consequence of the American people permitting the Jews to control their government and to use American strength to advance the Jews' interest at the expense of everyone else's interests. When people are driven into a corner, as the non-Jewish people of the Middle East have been, sometimes they will fight back. That is happening now, and it will happen even more in the future. The Jews will scream for the blood of their enemies, as Dianne Feinstein and other Jews are now. Their lackeys in Washington will strike at their enemies for them, just as Bill Clinton and others before him did. And the consequence will be that the number of the Jews' enemies will grow without limit, and not just in the Middle East. Even here in the United States, there are many people, including many people who have never listened to one of my broadcasts and who probably would disagree with me on many fundamental issues, who understand exactly why the United States was attacked this week. Not everyone in this country is a soccer mom or a baseball fan or an Oprah viewer. Some people can still think for themselves. Actually, millions of them can. And at least some of these millions know that it was no gratuitous attack out of the blue by Middle Eastern terrorists which is responsible for all those deaths in New York and Washington. They understand that when a nation no longer has leaders whose primary concern is the security and welfare of the nation, then bad things are likely to begin happening. They understand that the people who flew those planes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon did it because they had been pushed into a corner by the U.S. government acting on behalf of the Jews instead of on behalf of the American people. Certainly, the soccer moms and the baseball fans will have their anger directed toward Arabs and Muslims, but there will be plenty of people who will understand that as long as we continue to let the Jews control our country, one calamity after another will be inflicted on us. I certainly intend to do everything I can to help even more people understand that. 4 million subscribers to Time magazine had a chance to read Charles Krauthammer's explanation that terrorism and assassination are all right when it's the Jews assassinating their enemies. And those 4 million Time subscribers will read in the weeks ahead why terrorism and assassination are reprehensible and must be punished severely when it's the Jews' enemies striking back in desperation. But you know, not everyone will swallow that line. After the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City, which clearly was a reprisal against the government for the government's mass murder of innocent civilians in Waco 2 years earlier, the mass media largely ignored this linkage and tried to place the blame for the bombing on right-wing extremists. Some of them still refer to me as the architect of that bombing. Now they will try to keep the public from tracing the blame for the attacks this week back to the long-standing subservience of the U.S. government to Israel. Every media spokesman and every politician is referring to this week's attacks as cowardly and unprovoked. That's right. The Jewish party line, and therefore the party line of every media spokesman and every politician, is that the attacks were unprovoked. I've been listening to them all week, and not one of them will even hint at the possibility that maybe there was a reason for these attacks, that they were provoked by our own behavior. It's a no-no even to consider that. But that sort of deception is not going to work as well as it has in the past. A lot of people are going to figure it out, and I'm going to help them. And you should too, because the reprisals against America are just beginning. Many, many more innocent people will be killed because of what the U.S. government has done at the behest of the Jews. We already have killed close to 1 million people in Iraq alone because the Jews demanded it. The Jews, from Madeleine Albright on down, demanded that we maintain the blockade that is starving Iraqi children. That is a provocation, and it is only one among many. More and more people need to think about that when looking for those ultimately responsible for this week's attacks. And as I said, this week's attacks are just the beginning of what's in store for America. Of course, I don't know exactly what will be next, but certainly biological terrorism is coming. When it does come, the death toll will dwarf anything we've seen so far. And again, most of the television viewers will believe whatever the Jews tell them to believe, and Mr. Bush will declare the biological attack unprovoked, and he will order the bombing of still more aspirin factories in Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan and Sudan in order to show the lemmings that he is a strong leader and is doing something. But among the people who can think for themselves, the number who will understand where to place the blame will continue to grow. And the demand for a real solution, a final solution, will grow too. In this new era, I won't be the only one pointing the finger of blame in the right direction and talking about final solutions to our problem. Thanks for being with me again today.